What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
Yesterday, I spent almost my entire day with community members from a broad swath of organizations that have been working for months to prevent the renewal of the Flock contract for a whopping $2.25 million in the city of Oakland. From a press conference in the morning to a five-hour city council meeting at night, I love to run hour four to be transparent, with hundreds of people telling council no to surveillance. Honestly, I was in love with Oakland last night. I was in love with the people. I was reminded of people power in a time where it feels like at every turn our power is being stripped away from us. They said no to surveillance. All races, colors, creeds, ages, and class, and not just screaming no to surveillance, but armed with facts and data and information about impact, something the other side and the council members themselves, most of them, not all, we'll get to that in a minute, didn't have or were willingly, willfully ignoring. It was a true demonstration of people power and much needed in a city where our city council, Panther Ground, has swung center right, with the exception of Councilmember Carol Fife. Ultimately, the people won, but only because Councilmember Ken Houston made a massive mistake by saying ahead of the vote that they already had the votes and they should just move it along the city council without any further debate. I'm going to play that clip a little later. That would be an ethics violation at best, illegal at worst, and you best believe I'm digging to figure out which. In all honesty, I figured the people were going to lose because this council, specifically Councilmember Charlene Wong, District 2, Councilmember Rowena Brown, All City, Councilmember Ken Houston, District 7, Councilmember Kevin Jenkins, District 6, and Janani Ramachandran, District 4, I name names, as you all know, have demonstrated over and over again, from defunding the Arts and Culture Commission, people won that back, to illegally removing two duly appointed police commissioners, to pushing through a violent homeless abatement plan, to supporting OPD's attempts in acquiring military-grade equipment, to last night's Flock fight, that they have an agenda. A law and order right-wing reflective of MAGA politics agenda that they intend to push with force here in one of the most progressive cities in the country. I have no evidence of who was pushing them, what deals have been made, but what I am clear about is that they are unified in their goal. They don't care about hundreds of people dissenting. They don't care about how harmed the most marginalized among us will be. They don't care about facts and data. None of that comes into play. That's what I have watched with my own two eyes play out at council over and over again. At this point, not even logic and rationale work. Their base, giving them the backing to push this right-wing agenda, also comes in all races, colors, and creeds, though the class is something to pay attention to. They spew concern for public safety, but behave in unhinged and violent ways, from threatening to harm Black women to spreading lies about organizations and leaders, stating opinions and feelings like they are facts, fear-mongering and harassing, and yet they tell us they are who we should follow to an Oakland that works for us all. Yesterday, Chris Moore, a white man and former candidate for Alameda County Board of Supervisors, repeatedly screamed maniacally, that's the word, at me outside of city council that I was a white woman. A cisgendered white man trying to strip me of my Blackness, his homeboy, his sidekick, Twan, I want to say his name correctly, Neil, of Asians Unite, screamed that I need to be silenced. This is the same man who compared being a landlord during COVID and having to provide shelter to people who couldn't go outside and earn a living. He compared that to slavery. Yesterday, he said that I should be silent. Silence how, Twan? In the age of Trump, what exactly does that mean? I share all of this with you all, first of all, because you know what I do on this platform, expose, agitate, and build, but really in hopes of waking some of you up to the reality of the political conditions here in Oakland and actually in municipalities across the country, where left-leaning DAs have been removed, police commissions are being dismantled, and gains made in 2020 around police accountability are being rolled back. Conditions that exacerbate, not protect, the people from the agenda, the fascist agenda at the federal level. Pay attention, stay ready, get engaged, find real news and messengers you trust and follow them. And of course, as always, organize. All right, enough of me. That takes us to 8:10 in the morning here on Law and Disorder. I am your host, Kat Brooks. Our focus today, y'all, and LA, tune in, because this conversation is relevant for cities, as I mentioned, across the country. Flock is trying to be everywhere. They are already in Los Angeles. Our first guest is Sarah Hamid, Director of Strategic Programming at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Kat.
Right. Well, first we can do a little heavy deals because the people won. We can
the people
do that.
Did win. The
We're
people
to do
did
that
win.
On this show. The people won. For folks, I want to do a little bit of review. So we're not talking inside baseball. Remind folks why people were so concerned about the renewal of Flock.
So this contract that was put in front of the City Council and the Public Safety Committee is more than just Flock ALPR cameras. Flock ALPR cameras, which is a data sharing network of law enforcement data that captures license plate information as cars drive by these cameras, and has scaled so massively that there are multiple lawsuits in place right now, in effect, that are arguing that this is an unconstitutional level of surveillance. So this contract would have taken these ALPR cameras and made them a permanent fixture in Oakland for the next 2 years under Oakland's budget, and moved them over to Oakland's own budget, but also would have added 40 PTZ cameras, pan, tilt, zoom cameras, which are surveillance cameras that are remote operable, and they can also be sharing that feed to other law enforcement agencies. It would also have consolidated a bunch of different surveillance networks in business districts, downtown Oakland, basically private surveillance networks with OPD's surveillance network, and would have all done it with a back-end infrastructure that was Flock OS, right? And the last thing on the, in this massive packet that they put together is a sole service provider waiver, which made the argument that Flock is the only one uniquely positioned to provide this super technical bundle that they crafted themselves, basically setting Oakland up for vendor lock-in for the next set of massive surveillance procurements, including drones, which we know that Flock has been in conversation with for the city of Oakland for a couple of years now, right? And so, folks showed up because this isn't just a massive, massive expansion of surveillance capacity for the OPD. It's a massive expansion of surveillance capacity for this one single vendor, Flock Safety. And that one single vendor has been on headlines across the country all year because that one single vendor keeps showing up in massively untrustworthy ways. They say, for instance, that federal agencies don't have access to Flock Safety data, and investigative journalists keep finding evidence that they do. They say, for instance, that they've built a network in which sharing can be stopped at any time, but over and over and over again, evidence surfaces that accidental sharing is massively a problem in this network, that informal sharing is a massive problem in this network, and they scaled so quickly that they built a technical system that can't stop either of those things. They say things all the time, like, for instance, our technology isn't used to criminalize people who are accessing abortion healthcare. And we find out through investigative research that that's not true. So it's not just about the massive expansion in surveillance at a time in which fascism is creeping down everyone's neck in this country and putting really, really vulnerable members of Oakland at risk, but it's also doing so through this single, highly untrustworthy vendor.
Sarah Hammond, can you help us understand what the non-renewal means? What happens next?
So a few things can happen, from my understanding, and I'm not an Oakland expert, but a few things can happen. It needs to go back to the full council for a vote, and the full council needs to, from my understanding, vote on it. But this died in committee last night, and that's what I'm hearing from community, right?
Yeah.
And so even if there's pathways to see this fight happen again, what happened yesterday and what happened last night is over 100 people showed up and said no to this thing. And that group isn't demobilized. They're not keeping their eye off the docket. If this thing comes back to full council, they are ready and they're organized to address this. But it died in committee last night because of simple things like Commissioner Fife and Commissioner Brown asking for a reduction in the data retention period, right? They asked for amendments to try and make this system safer in any way that they can. And even that was rejected, which shows you really blatantly what the intent is here.
So question, because I learned some things last night as I was sitting there and I was listening, and there were experts that the community showed up and showed out. They were talking about a back door that was built into Flock specifically that the feds can access. One of the things that came up, however, because I know you look at this around the country, was that the cameras, the systems belong to Flock, and that actually in the contract, it said that the city cannot take them down, touch them, dismantle them, and that in other cities where cities are ending their contracts with Flock and they have taken them down, that Flock has gone and reinstalled them. Wondering if you can shed light on that, because that perhaps is a possible scenario in Oakland.
There is a beautiful image the journalist took in Evanston, Illinois, of trash bags covering a Flock camera because that is all the city can do right now. Because Flock is so insistent that their cameras stay up in that city, even though community and council decided that Flock does not only make their city safe, it puts their community members at risk. And that image, if you can find it, I would love for you to share that image
Okay.
because that's what's happening.
Looking
Flock
up.
is fighting in places like Evanston. It's fighting back in places like Springfield, Oregon. It's fighting back in a bunch of places because they're recognizing that there is this nationwide movement happening where folks are recognizing that municipal governments and cities aren't just the first line of defense against fascism, they're also the first line of exposure through these surveillance contracts. And shutting off these contracts with problematic companies like Flock Safety is the only way to keep their community members safe.
And that's what community members and we even had tech bros in there last night being like, nah, this a dude came up and said that, he was a tech bro, my words, not his. And he was like, so just FYI, it's a bad idea to go into business with venture capitalists. And I'm gonna get in with my next guest about who some of those venture capitalists are. Sarah, can you talk at all about if there is any connection between Flock and the people that fund Flock and what we are seeing nationally in the push for for more surveillance of the people?
Yeah, absolutely. We're seeing this national trend where the entire country's economy, it seems like the entire stock market, is being held up by really problematic entities like Palantir, right? Who are in the business of surveilling, who are in the business of creating mechanisms that can be used to target entire categories of people. And it's happening very, 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 very quickly. Now, there's a long history in this country of surveillance technology. Black and brown folks and Native folks know this for a very, very long time because those technologies have been tested on our communities and in our neighborhoods, right? But we're also living in this moment where tech is evolving very quickly and capacities are becoming much cheaper and easier to buy. So that vision for that surveillance, like an ecosystem that law enforcement may have wanted 20 years ago, is actually now possible. And that's why all of these contracts are being handed out to companies that are wanting to, that are willing to build these systems to target those communities that they don't care about and to put those communities at risk. Because the other thing that happened, of course, is interest rates went up. So the entire market incentive for these companies have shifted too. And they're moving towards violence profiteering, surveillance profiteering, war profiteering in some instances, because this is where the money is right now. And you have a government that's willing to give out these contracts. So there's this. Not only is fascism shifting politically, not only is it shifting in the culture, the technological apparatus of fascism is changing too. But so are the people, right? They're recognizing this happening in front of them and they're pushing back. And there's ways in which people are talking about technology. Now, I've been doing this work for a very, very long time. There are ways in which people are talking about technology that I've never heard them talk about. Like you said, they're showing up to this council member, this public safety committee hearing with facts, with evidence. They're doing their research. The people are studied on this right now, and they're really pushing back. So yes, fascism is growing, so is techno-fascism, but so is people power.
Right on, Sarah. Those are beautiful words to end on. I'm definitely gonna have you back because we fall on this. Maybe me and you can get into the history of surveillance in this country. I think that'd be a good segment to bring to the people. Thank you for your time. I know
Absolutely.
you're real busy.
Thank you.
Appreciate you.
Of
All
course,
right.
of course.
We've been speaking to Sarah Hamid, Director of Strategic Programming at Electronic Frontier Foundation. All right, that takes us to 8:22 in the morning here on Law and Disorder. Before I bring on my next two guests, I want to give you all a little taste of what was happening in Oakland City Council chambers yesterday at the Public Safety Committee meeting. For the record, the council members on that committee meeting are Council Member Charlene Wong, District 2, Council Member Ken Houston, District 7, Council Member Rowena Brown, all city, and Council Member Carol Fife, District 3. I'm gonna leave that alone for a minute. Go ahead. Let's roll that tape of public comment.
Senior who has lived in Oakland my whole life, and I urge you to reject Flock's $2.25 million contract. This isn't just a camera system. It's a mass surveillance network that will track every single one of us, making a searchable database that tracks our movements. This data will be accessible to over 5,000 different agencies, including ICE. We're a sanctuary city, but this camera system strips our city of exactly that protection. Just last July, more than one federal agency illegally accessed Oakland's license plate data. Local police cannot stop federal access to our information, and the only way to protect our immigrant communities is to not build this database in the first place. Even more than that, Flock is not trustworthy at all. They have already been caught using 50 million stolen data points, lying to communities, and even reinstalling cameras in cities that fired them. Flock cannot be trusted with our data or our money at all. This $2.25 million is a choice. We can fund a surveillance system that criminalizes our community, or we can invest in what truly creates safety,
mental health crisis response,
violence prevention, and youth programs.
My name is Edwin. I'm a student and resident of Oakland, alongside with the Ella Baker Center. I'm here today to reject the proposal of OPD's community safety, camera system, safety system, and Flock safety contract. Oakland is a sanctuary city where our cameras are vulnerable. Mass surveillance systems like ALPR and Flocks will collect data where the Trump administration can seize and also abuse.
Hello, my name is Bria Woodland. I'm a constituent of District 3. Hi, Ms. 5. And I'm here to oppose the Flock contract. My safety should not come at the expense of my privacy. Once again, safety does not come at the expense of privacy. Surveillance has historically been used as a tool to criminalize and incarcerate Black people and queer people of color. We have been shown that OPD is unable to keep our data safe by the most recent leak in July, as well as seeing that they can't meet the basic standards to be relieved of the 22-year-long FBI oversight. So I cannot trust that they'll do what it takes to protect our data from ICE or any other fascist organization or agency seeking to exploit the people of Oakland. Oakland has influenced the entire country on the basis of sustaining and retaining human rights. People seeking sanctuary for any of their needs should not have to worry that their identity will be compromised. You told us today that they haven't even updated the CAD that would help the people of Oakland yesterday. So there's no reason why we should be spending as much money as we are when they have not been accountable, and there's no excuse for spending more money when they have failed to utilize the resources we currently have. Thank you.
Those were the voices of just some of the over 100 Oaklanders that showed up last night at City Council to say no to surveillance. So a couple of things happened last night, and one of our next guests can talk about it. A couple of things happened last night. One, the Flock issue was first on the agenda after, the business that any committee or council meeting has to go through before they start to get into the people's business. It was first on the agenda. One of the things that I've seen city council do repeatedly, and again, I'm talking about, and I just have to say it, there are seven city council members. I am talking about six of them. I'm not talking about District 3 council member Carol Fife. And I'm going to say that because that's what her record shows, and that's what her efforts on council show. Anywho, one of the things that I've seen council do repeatedly, and that's prior even to this council, right? This is over, I've been doing this, two decades at this point, sitting through those meetings. I keep saying I'm never going back, but I keep finding myself in those rooms, is when a lot of people come, right? Hundreds of people show up, because there was also overflow. So chambers were full and the two overflow rooms were basically full. One of the things they do in order to sort of wait people out is they flip the agenda. So they put the item that has the most people they want to talk at the end and the other items on the top in the hopes that, right, people will get tired, they will get home, they will say, never mind. The problem with that, it's always a problem, but the problem with that last night was that there were young people that showed up to speak. And a lot of them young people had to go home because it's a school night. So that made the people angry. And then the second thing that happened that made the people angry is that after council allowed the first people to, the young people that were left to come speak, a woman, I do not have her name, but a woman that was with the side that the pro-Flock people got up, normally council calls names and then you get to go. She got up and said, I'm cutting the line because I have to go. And council members Rowena Brown and council member Charlene Wong tried to allow her to go, and the chambers erupted in rage, right? So this is the side of the folks that we know that you are in conversation with, and this is the way you were leaning. They don't have to follow the rules. It got real hyphy in them chambers. It got so hyphy that they just forgoed the list and people people were able to speak. So that's the tone and tenor what we were dealing with this night. All right. Joining us next at 8:28 in the morning is Rami, an organizer with Palestinian Youth Movement. Good morning, Rami.
Good morning, Kat. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for being here. It's gonna be a quick one. I'm running through a lot of information today. So much happened. And Reem, the senior campaign director at the anti-surveillance nonprofit Fight for the Future and former privacy advocacy commissioner in Oakland, who was also at the press conference that I mentioned earlier in the show. Good morning, Reem.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. It's a long night.
I know. My comms guy Lance was calling me at 11 something tomorrow. He was just getting home. All right. I want to talk to you first. I want to talk to you about an angle that didn't come up last night. I talked about who funds Flock. One of the funders of Flock is Palantir. And I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about Palantir surveillance in Gaza and they're profiting, they're benefiting from the genocide.
Yeah. So thank you for bringing this up, Kat. I mean, it seemed like a very emotional night and also a very powerful night that happened last night with the deal not going through, the deal that would scam city residents in Oakland. We know that Gaza is a testing ground. We know that the last 2 years have shown what surveillance, what artificial intelligence looks like in an open-air prison that is fully backed by the United States. We see the ways that the corporations, which are the intangible link in all of this, when we think about military technology, when we think about governments surveilling, incarcerating, detaining people against their will, disappearing people, we know that the corporations are the ones that create those technologies. They're the ones that test those technologies, and they're the ones that are contracted. And they usually go by silently. So in Gaza, we have seen AI targeting that has resulted in the murder of over 100,000 people, full stop. AI has created an environment in Gaza that is used as, people love to use the argument that AI works by itself, it works independently, and it's just the people and the governments that administrate it. That's not true. AI is a human-powered resource. And companies like Palantir, which have used or provided AI for Israel's top intelligence units, Unit 8200, which have targeted families, targeted homes in Gaza, and they also have a lot of policies where there's a policy called Where's Daddy? Where Palestinian men will leave their homes, and when they return to their homes, their entire family is bombed. So they call that policy Where's Daddy? Because when daddy returns home, that's when the entire family is bombed. This is just one of many, many Israeli policies. I'm thinking about Lavender, a lot of other policies where Palestinians are extrajudicially murdered, much like Black and Latino folks are here in the United States. Their families are killed, all under the guise of terrorism, under the guise of them being rendered killable. And this is all at the hands of Google, of Palantir, of Microsoft. There was a rally yesterday confronting Microsoft in San Francisco. And companies like Palantir, led by Peter Thiel, who's also a founder of the Flock program, are taking this data in Gaza and they are bringing it back to the United States. That is the goal of the United States in their U.S.-backed genocide in Gaza. It's not just to be a partner in this colonization. It's also to bring back these quote unquote war tested technologies back to the United States to test on Black and brown people here. And this just had an opportunity in Oakland. And I think that's what makes it so disgusting.
Do it for me every time, Rami. That is exactly, that's exactly the connection I wanted to make here. All right, Reem, you taught me something new yesterday that I didn't. I learned so much yesterday. We see all of these signs and we see hear all these statements from the opposition talking about Flock keeps us safe, Flock solves crimes. There was even some meme that went around that says caught 98 criminals, blah, 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 blah. You made a point at the press conference yesterday that there is only one report that actually says that Flock keeps people safer as a successful public safety tool. Can you talk a little bit about that and who wrote that report?
I think somebody else may have made that point, but I think they had mentioned that it was something cited from Flock research itself. I think there was another researcher there that broke down that most of the times when, you know, the opposition is mentioning Flock's name or mentioning the success, they're citing directly from, you know, the clearly one-sided research that Flock, you know, puts out there. So, yeah, it's not surprising, though, to me, you know, in my experience on the Privacy Advisory Commission, we're often hearing from tech vendors and being spoon-fed whatever's in their marketing materials, and it's just so much harder to be able to verify any of that stuff because it's one-sided access oftentimes to that data. And so it definitely wasn't a surprise.
My question for you, and then I've got to move on to our next guest. From your perch on the Privacy Advocacy Commission and also your role in Fight for the Future, where's the lie around public safety? Why are these policies dangerous? And then part two of that is there are lots of folks from the tech industry that showed up last night that said this was a bad idea. Your take on that?
Yeah, I'm so grateful actually that they did show up because I think they raised a lot of good points. I'm not a cybersecurity expert, but we had plenty in the room. And the thing that was so infuriating to me was when the Flock representative was brought to talk about their protocol. This is exactly where you bring an external independent expert that can actually verify these claims. You don't let the vendor just speak from their marketing materials share whatever bogus canned answer that they give. But in general, like, I think the public safety issue, it's a tough one because it's like we hear these intense stories of like cherry picked anecdotes where this technology works, but the picture that they don't share is often like what happens when these things go wrong, right? You know, I think a lot of people spoke to the problems when Flock databases are searched and used in immigration raids, abortion, whatnot. But one thing that they don't talk about is just how so many police departments over-rely on the technology, right? And so, you know, there have been multiple cases of people driving and then pulled over by the cops and held at gunpoint because of an ALPR alert that they did not verify. And so this over-reliance literally puts everyday people in danger as well. And we're not talking enough about that either, because like there's a whole other set of harms that happen, you know, when this stuff goes wrong or when police don't know how to use it or they over-rely on it. And so I think it's incredibly dangerous to public safety, right, to push surveillance technology as a solution. Sorry, there's a...
No, we're good. All right, y'all. I'm going to read these two things. Flock Representative Trevor Chandler is a liaison, and he worked for AIPAC for 3 years. He is part of the political scene in San Francisco, I believe. We will post the 48 Hills article about that in the archive of the show. Thank you both. I got to move on to the next guest. I will see / talk to both of you, I'm sure, soon, because we got work to do, yes?
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay, we have been speaking to Rami, an organizer with the Palestinian Youth Movement, and Reem, senior campaign director at the anti-surveillance nonprofit Fight for the Future and a former privacy advocacy commissioner in Oakland. Joining us next is Dr. Tanisha Cannon, who's the managing director for legal services for prisoners with children and all of us are none. Good morning, Tanisha.
Good morning, Kat.
I should have waited for my commentary about what happened to the young people until you were on here, because, you know, that directly impacted some of the folks that you brought. If you could just talk about how you felt about how the young people were treated last night and the shenanigans of moving the agenda around and what that meant in terms of how many young people did not get to express their opinion. That's part one of the question. Then part two is the concerns about how this technology impacts Black and brown youth in particular.
Yes, absolutely. I think we all recognized it was a stall tactic since the last time we should have had the meeting. What I would say is that I'm so happy that the youth came out and exercised their civic engagement and are really worried about that. And that really just makes me hopeful. But I think in general, knowing that, you know, this is a school night, this is a work day, and people are coming to talk about things that really matter to them, and especially our Black and brown youth. And I think about this even with my son. The very first time I recognized that he recognized how hard this is gonna be for him as a Black man was us walking through a beauty supply, and he was 12 years old, and him getting followed. And he told me how he felt about that. And I knew then that I had to recognize what is going on with our youth and how protective we have to be. And since then, he's been active and engaged in great places like Urban Peace Movement and Ella Baker Center. And they really brought out the youth. And I'm glad that a few youth were able to speak. But I did recognize that at least 12 of them left early.
Yeah, it was a school night. I'm going to bring in, we got about 17 minutes left in this segment. I've been trying to pack as much as I can into it. I'm going to keep you on, though, as I bring in my next two guests, because I want to play a clip of commentary by Councilmember Ken Houston, and I want to get your response to it before I let you go. All right, joining us is Reverend Jeremy McCants, a faith-rooted organizer for East Bay Alliance for Sustainable Economy, or EBACE, an organization committed to fighting for equitable and economic power in the Bay Area, as well as minister at the historic Allen Temple Baptist Church in Oakland. We are also joined by Brian Hofer, a member of the Oakland Privacy Council Committee and executive director of Secure Justice. Secure Justice filed a lawsuit against the city of Oakland yesterday for OPD's alleged sharing, I hate to say alleged because we're on the radio, of surveillance data with federal agencies. Y'all, before I get into the various things I want to talk to you about, I want to play a clip from Councilmember Ken Houston that happened at the end of the meeting, and I want to get your response. Let's roll that tape, please.
Are you accepting the amendments that Councilmember Wang has uplifted as a part of it?
What I wanted to do is just move it to the full council so we can all speak on it and talk. And if they, because I like to move it the way it is and just see what the full council wants.
I think it's our job to hash it out here in committee, Councilmember Houston. I would rather do that. So do you accept?
So let me just share this. It's going to be hashed out no matter what, because if we got 3-1, this is not for it. It's going to be a non-consent anyway.
So are you denying the amendment?
Give me a few minutes. Let me just write something down. Give me a second. I don't like to make any quick decisions. I'll go with your. I don't want to step on your toes. This is your. You chair this, and I wouldn't want no one stepping on mine. So, I'll, with your amendments, we can move it.
Okay, thank you, Councilmember Houston.
So what struck me there was that Councilmember Houston said, we have the votes 3-1. We know who the one is. It's Councilmember Fife. The three are Wang, Brown, and Houston. Meaning that before they sat down in their seats, they had made a decision about which way the vote was going to go. Brian, you were more entrenched in sort of the weeds of the way all this stuff works because it gives me a headache. So thank you for doing that work. Is that normal? Is that appropriate? Are they supposed to have made agreements? I mean, I know that people like try to, you know, count votes, but there's something that felt real unethical about that and made the people sort of explode inside chambers.
Yeah, I think there's two problems that popped up right there is possible Brown Act violations, state law, a majority of this committee, so there's four people. At most, Councilmember Houston could have only talked to one other of those three people. So if he talked to three people and thought he had three votes, that is a Brown Act violation. It also just the delay in the way he stumbled almost looked like he was taking coaching from someone else, you know, via text message or something secret, presumably from another council member on the full body, Brown Act violation. I've also been informed from other folks that prior to the meeting, other members of the full body had said they already had the votes and that they expected the item to go straight to the council on consent calendar. We have seen with this body a very consistent practice of rule breaking, special meeting shenanigans, gamesmanship to really take away the people's right to participate. And I think we saw that last night.
As I said to a reporter was asking me in an interview outside chambers what I thought was going to happen. And I said, quite frankly, I can't tell you because the rules don't apply to these folks. They do what they want to do regardless of what they're supposed to do. And that was attempted last night. Thank you for that, Brian. Tanisha, your response to that. And I'm coming to you, Pastor.
I would say my response is we being there at the meeting, we noticed that he wasn't even present and we're delaying. We have older folks, we have younger folks that are sitting in this meeting after hours and you couldn't even be here to look people in their face. He sat on Zoom and we all know that even in the room with him, he had to identify that there were people over 18 with him. He mentioned his mother was there, but like Brian says, who else was really in that room and who were you getting information from? So that's really concerning to me.
Yeah, I can't do it on the air. I think it'd be an FCC violation, but I got thoughts about who, and I'll be walking that line anyway. I got thoughts about who that was, and I'll probably bring it up in an Instagram later on my personal page. Pastor, your thoughts about what you just heard?
No worries, Kat. Hold your peace, as we would say. Hold your peace. And thank you to Kat and to KPFA, to the distinguished guests as well, Brian and Tanisha. Yeah, I think it is, you know, I've been saying it for probably the past 2 years, maybe even more, that, you know, Oakland and even probably all politics within America right now is a microcosm of what's going on the federal level. And the boldness and the arrogance, the ignorance, just the unmitigated gall that is going on in the federal level is just folks are empowered and not in a good way, as empowerment should be. And so just echoing everything that has already been lifted, it is really just disheartening that folks are still moving with hidden agendas and sacrificing the goodwill and the safety of people, and primarily of Black and Brown people every day. So, it's nothing that we don't know, but it is always just a different blow when you see it right in front of your face and folks still try to act like they don't know what they're doing. It's just immoral and disheartening.
Pastor, I'm going to hold you, and I'm trying to frame this question in a way that makes sense and doesn't put you in too sticky of a position. One of the things that we've seen, right, since the backlash against defund happened is Black faces leading the charge. Historical institutions like the Oakland branch of the NAACP, though I'm going to do a segment on the history of the NAACP's politics because people, I think, will find it surprising. But also black churches, black pastors, right, that are part of the establishment and often become the answer to Black faces like Dr. Cannon's or mine, right? And are caught up in this narrative about our communities aren't safe and we need more police, which is really contradictory to the role that cops have historically and do play in our communities. And I know that Michael, Pastor Michael McBride tries to do some organizing around pastors, and so I've heard a bit from him about how difficult that is. And I'm just, from your perch as a member of that community, if you could talk just for a little bit about that dynamic and what do we do? Because that is, even though I know membership in churches is dwindling, I know there's less and less people, but it is still, and I think will always be a cornerstone of community, right, for Black folks. What do we do?
Absolutely, and I think that is a timely question. And just to rectify, I'm no longer historically or formally connected with Allen Temple.
Okay, sorry.
No worries. I need to update my bio. But I do now serve as the senior pastor of Imani Community Church in Oakland as well. And yeah, I think this is a millennia old kind of question and predicament that even within, you know, Dr. King's movement, the civil rights movement, that only really 10 to 15% of Black churches actually supported the civil rights movement. Right. So even King and Abernathy and all those who led the civil rights movement, SNCC, and even the Rainbow Coalition, right? There was always tensions within the intra-community of Black churches, and that is still prevalent today. I think it is, again, as you said, that Black people are not a monolith, and neither are Black churches, right? And neither are Black pastors. And I think there is a sense on the broader scope, a sense of intracommunal healing that needs to happen and that pastors and Black churches need to be at the forefront of, and for Black churches not to be afraid of having difficult conversations within their own pews. And I think that trickles, or not necessarily trickles, but pastors take advantage of that. They understand if they get behind a certain banner that they are, again, unfortunately, some pastors just see church as a business, right? Mm-hmm. That it is a business, and that you can leverage the Black church for economic gain. And in as a Christian, right, that is what makes Jesus's ministry so powerful, because Jesus comes in making political statements, right? Jesus and them affirming Jesus as King and as Lord was a political statement, because Caesar was King and Lord, right? And so you have this, essentially this conundrum of how do we live out our faith in the midst of empire? And where does the synagogue, where does the church, where does our beliefs as people of faith, not necessarily just let things be, but how do we offer that counter narrative that, hey, like, I understand that the government is doing this role and serves this purpose, which we're not saying that the government does not have a purpose, but we're saying that as the church, we hold them accountable to the purpose of always speaking and advocating for the well-being of the people. So I'm sure that's a roundabout answer, but I think it is, unfortunately, that we as Black folks in general have to have real conversations about folks who sell us out, being whatever title they have, and that that is a very hard thing to navigate, especially within just local politics and within Oakland, when you have so many pastors who are pivoting and leveraging with empire so that they can line their own pockets. And that's really the goal, what comes off as the goal of what they do. And so the pastors, you know, such as myself and those who do hold up the bloodstained banner and the banner of justice, equity, and inclusivity, in whatever ways that may come out, and as it pertains to public safety and community safety, we do have to have some conversation around how the church does become an advocate for community safety versus public safety. And I think that's a distinction that we keep missing.
Oh, I like that. I was going to do an antidote, but I ain't got time. Maybe if I do at the end, I will. Look at me. There I go. Libby Schaff, when we were breaking her first curfew, called the Black pastors in for me to shut me down. And then I'm not going to say the names because I don't have consent, but I got to tell you, at least six of them pastors called me and say, yo, we ain't with this cat. Y'all keep doing what you're doing in the streets. So I don't want to condemn all Black pastors because we got something about that business. Like yourself, Pastor McCants. Brian Hofer, yesterday, when all of this kerfuffle was happening in the people's fight to stop Flock Secure, Justice filed a lawsuit. Talk to us.
Yeah, well, the sad news is same thing I did before. I just sued them on illegal data sharing over license plate reader data a couple years ago. Our settlement agreement isn't even 2 years old. The very first week we got Flock, we went right back to violating the same state law and our use policy. And at the volume today, our old system, maybe there's thousands of violations. Today, we're collecting about 48 million scans per month, hundreds of millions of plates per year. And we're exposing this, providing unfettered direct access to our data. And this is sensitive location data. You know, I think people, and maybe I'm kind of guilty, I keep talking about data. This is valuable, obviously, which is why people are looking for it. It reveals sensitive locations and patterns and associations. And I can figure anything out about you from these data points. And we're just giving them away, essentially. And the state law is clear. We recently saw the Attorney General sue El Cajon over this. He sent thousands of warning letters over the years. This is an 8-year-old law, and OPD has been violating it for all but 7 months when we didn't have license plate readers. And, you know, it calls into question now if we can believe anything, because in that annual report we got, they said no use policy violations, even though they knew at that time ICE had already accessed the data. OPD itself had been providing data to the feds, like the FBI and other agencies. And you notice, like last night and during that earlier July 15th Public Safety Committee special report, that was a complete waste and performative art, but it was in response to the San Francisco Standard article. They keep talking specifically about ICE. And obviously that's important, it's front of mind, but SB 34 prohibits data sharing with any federal agency. And as we all know, these other federal agencies, FBI, DEA, Marshals, ATF, they are being repurposed to do immigration work. We're seeing it on TV all the time as they kidnap people off the street. So, we are aiding in federal immigration efforts. We are wantonly, intentionally violating the state law millions of times, and we've lied. The city promised they wouldn't do it in a settlement agreement. They're pretending there's no use policy violation. So, you know, that was one of the reasons that I actually resigned from the Privacy Commission recently, because,
I missed that, sorry.
You know, 10 years. I did this for 10 years. And you know, I hate to admit failure, but I don't really think I improved the culture at the police department. The final trigger point was that July 15 OPD response where they just viciously attacked the journalist. No remorse. There was just no remorse whatsoever. And so I think the courts are going to have to look at this very seriously, because this is the second time in just 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of frustration in the room last night, right? And has been repeatedly as we are forced as the public to sit there and listen to what we know are blatant lies, right? And then get chastised by particularly Councilmember Wong, right, for having a reaction. It's like, no, you sit there, you be gaslit and you be quiet. So I want to give each of you like 20 seconds for your final comments, and then I got to get going. I'm going to get in trouble. Dr. Cannon, I'm going to start with you. 25 seconds, final comments.
Okay. I guess I think we know that, like, at the end of the day, fear sells, right? And safety does not. Like, they're profiting from it. And even seeing that the district attorney from San Jose was part of the discussion, which completely, it's just like, are you being lobbied? We know to save our communities, we have to involve our communities, not to surveillance them. We sat there and we heard real facts directly from the Oakland Police Department that crime is going down. And we know that this national narrative is not telling what's really happening. And progress takes time. And I want us to continue to do the work that we're doing. Jeremy, Brian, Kat, we just got to keep on pushing. And we're going to get there. And thank you for creating this space.
Thanks for being there. Brian, two sentences. I'm right at time.
This is not the only lawsuit coming. There's going to be a class action money damages, and that one's going to hurt. It's going to really, people are going to understand that we better start following the law.
Pastor, I know you're a pastor, but I just, real fast.
I understand. But no, the moral call is always, and as a Christian, as a man of faith, the biblical principles is that the divine system that God wants us all to live in is to care for one another, that we are all, you know, that we are all human, that we are all called to sacrifice of ourselves and of our resources for each other, and not to be cutting deals behind the table, behind the scenes, at the expense of our own people.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.